Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The month of May typically has some of the most pleasant weather of the year. Spring is in full bloom, but yet it usually isn't too hot or too cool. Then there was May 2018. It seemed as though it rained every day during the month of May. It didn't, but there was a lot of precipitation. And even though it was the first day of June, some places received more than 4 inches of rainfall Friday night, leading to flash flooding. The temperatures also weren't very May-like. 90 degrees on May 26th and just above 30 on May 1st. And even though it was the first day of June, some places, as I said, received that rainfall Friday night. Or weather patterns and any other questions about weather, that's a part of today's Smart Talk. Our guest is Eric Hurst, Director of Weather Information Center at Millersville University. Professor Hurst, welcome to the program.
Oh, glad to be with you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, this is your opportunity to ask a question about the weather. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page or on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Eric Hurst, how wet was it in May here in central PA?
Yeah, well, it was around a top 10 kind of month in terms of rainfall. Of course, neighborhood to neighborhood, county to county, there's always some differences this time of year because, you know, showers and thunderstorms can hit one spot a lot harder than others. But as a ballpark, most places picked up around 5 inches of rain. And the normal rainfall, you know, when you're talking a long-term average for May, is more in the order of 3.5 inches. So it was substantially above average. And in terms of heading into the summer season, that's a good thing because, you know, some years you have a dry spring and that sets you up for a droughty or potentially droughty summer. That certainly doesn't look like the case this year with all the rain we've had in recent weeks.
So why so much rain?
Well, you know, we've had a very active jet stream, and this really goes back to March. Beginning with March and then right through April and May, the jet stream has been quite active across the northern tier states, across the Dakotas, across the Great Lakes, and into the northeast and northern mid-Atlantic. And that active storm track has brought a lot of, people generally call them clipper systems, these fast-moving low-pressure centers. So they're not big, organized low-pressure centers, but more fast-moving disturbances that what you tend to get is a shot of warm air ahead of the disturbance, ahead of the approaching system, and then a shot of cold air behind it. So if you look at the temperature records in recent weeks, it's been kind of a roller coaster ride. Yeah, you mentioned that. You know, it could be 90 for a day, and then a few days later, it's 30 degrees cooler. And so that's kind of one of the hallmarks of this pattern is quite a large vacillation in temperatures. But also, when you're in that type of a setup, it tends to be fairly prolific in terms of generating showers and thunderstorms this time of year, especially as you get into June. Severe weather is certainly on our mind because this is climatologically when Pennsylvania is most at risk, is May, June, and July for severe storms. And if you get a couple of storms that track over the same location or stall over a location, like happened last Friday night down here in Lancaster, you can get flooding.
So. Yeah, talk about that. What did happen last Friday night in Lancaster County?
Yeah, it was a pretty remarkable event. You know, we had late last week, I remember here in the Weather Center talking to a few of our students, it was a very moist air mass. It was almost a tropical-like air mass, if you can think back to the end of last week.
Oh, I can think back to it. Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah, very, very sultry, almost kind of felt like an August air mass. You know, the high humidity, dew points is the metric that we like to look at meteorologically. When the dew point is around 70, that's a tropical air mass with a lot of water vapor. And so the air mass had a lot of moisture to be kind of wrung out of it, if you will, but yet you need a storm to do that. And well, in the case of last Friday night, a storm blew up kind of over eastern York County, drifted into western Lancaster County, and the steering winds, at least last Friday, the winds aloft, for the time being, were actually kind of weak. And so it led to the thunderstorm moving at a rate of just 3 or 4 or 5 miles per hour. That's a snail's pace for a thunderstorm. Typical thunderstorm often is moving at 20 or 30 miles an hour, and therefore when it hits your house, it's gone in 15 or 20 minutes. Well, that was not the case last Friday night, and so if you live around Mountville or Millersville or in that general area of western Lancaster County, that thunderstorm that blew up over eastern York drifted in and just kind of loitered there and eventually rained itself out over pretty much the same location, and hence there was a fairly large area of 3-inch rainfall that covered maybe, 10 or 15 square miles, but then there was kind of a bullseye over Mountville where there are 1 or 2 rain gauges that actually recorded over 5 inches in just 4 hours.
Wow.
And so when you're getting an inch an hour kind of rain for several hours, that is flash flooding territory, and that's exactly what happened over a very small area in western Lancaster County. You know, you went to other parts of the county. You know, I live northeast of the city, and we had about an inch of rain, no big deal.
Well, yeah, in northwestern Lancaster County, I know that there was no rain, maybe a shower or something like that.
You're exactly right. Up around E-Town and up towards Harrisburg, Middletown area, hardly anything. A few sprinkles fell. Now, there was additional rain over the weekend at those locations, but I'm talking specifically around midnight Friday night is when the flash flood occurred, and you're exactly right. Up in northern Lancaster County, just a few drops.
And what I'm going to do for our listeners is jump around on Eric Hirst today and ask a lot of weather-related questions. This is one of those times where any question about weather that you've ever had, kind of a weather 101 today. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. So some of the terms that you use today, Eric, I may just right away say, okay, explain that. One is dew point. I think that a lot of people are becoming more familiar, a lot of lay people are becoming more familiar with dew point and what it is, or to look for those higher dew points. But how would you explain dew points?
Yeah, that's kind of meteorology 101, it is kind of a confusing topic, but the dew point is an absolute measure of water vapor in the air. Like, if I gave you a cup full of water and said, you know, how many ounces of water or how many milliliters of water are in that cup, the value you would give me would be an absolute measure. It would tell me how much is there. Now, if I asked you what percent of the cup is filled with water, if it was half full, you'd say, well, it's 50% full. That's what relative humidity is, and that's what people commonly, or weathermen on TV commonly use to express water vapor in the air. But the problem with relative humidity, it's just a percent of the air's capacity. Again, the cup, if it's 50% full, it's half filled with water, but that doesn't tell you how much is actually there, because it's a function of how big the cup is. You know, if it's a little juice glass and it's 50% full, or it's a gigantic mug and it's 50% full, there's a different amount of water in the cup, even though they're both 50% full. And so that's why, you know, relative humidity, which is a percent, tells you something about how close you are to saturation, but it doesn't tell you anything about how much water vapor is actually in the air. So that's where dew point is beautiful, because the higher the dew point is, the more water vapor there is in the air. So kind of on the scale that we see in this part of the country, our dew points in the dead of winter could be down in the single digits or teens or 20s. That's a very dry air mass where there's hardly any water vapor, very, very few molecules of water vapor floating around. As the dew point climbs into the 50s, which is, by the way, where it's at today, if you walk outside, the dew point is currently around 53. That's kind of a mid amount of water vapor in the air. You can sense that, yeah, there's a little bit of moisture there, but it's not so oppressive. As the dew point climbs into the 60s and then approaches 70, that's when it starts to feel really soupy, that's the stuff of a more tropical air mass, something that comes out of the Gulf of Mexico, for instance, or up along the East Coast from off the Carolina coast, and the air, when it's coming out of the south in the summer, dew points can climb into the low or even mid-70s, and that's where you walk outside and it's oppressive, it's sultry, tropical, all those terms that we throw around here more commonly in August, but occasionally other times of the year if the conditions are right to get that air, you know, transported up here.
Yeah, I on Friday, I think I saw that at least in one place, it may have been Lancaster County, that the dew point was 73. And that yep. is high. And, I mean, you could tell as soon as you walked outside. But I have to tell you, Eric, you just gave us our Twitter quote for the day when you say that that's why dew point is beautiful. Never heard dew point described that way. But
Well, as a measure, as a parameter.
Right. I understand what you said.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, that's one of the challenging things as a meteorologist is, you know, I work in a weather center at a university, one of the top universities in the country to study meteorology. And so we have our nose in textbooks. We have our nose in technical talk, you know, here. But then when you're trying to communicate to the layperson, to the public, to a decision maker, or to a radio audience, you can't talk in that high-end terminology. You got to make it understandable to the layperson, and that's challenging. But that's also something that, I'm a kind of a veteran here, having done this for 30 years, and hopefully it's a skill you develop is taking the complex and trying to make it understandable. And I guess that's what we're doing here today on your
yep.
radio show.
Here's we have a phone call here from Tim in Carlisle. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Quick question. This may just be my perception, but I feel like the majority of the weekends over maybe the past year and a half have either been wet or rainy, with a lot of drier, nicer weather during the middle of the week, Monday to Friday. Is there any kind of phenomenon that describes that, or anything like in the current weather patterns that have brought that up?
Well, I think we lost them. Eric, what about that?
Yeah, well, Tim, the term for it is bad luck, and I'll tell you, I feel the pain as much as anyone does, because I'm someone who likes to spend my weekends outdoors, recreating with my family, and in terms of this year, this spring in particular, March and April were just brutal, and even into May, obviously, it does seem like pretty much every weekend there's been at least showers around. And if you go back to March and April, it was cold and snow showers around. And so it's just been a function of that jet stream being more overhead, over our heads more of the time. You know, typically the jet stream kind of wavers and vacillates across the country, and there's different phenomena, blocking patterns that form over the Atlantic Ocean, and different features on a kind of a hemispheric scale that affect where the jet stream lines up. Well, for whatever reason, or a combination of reasons, the jet stream has been consistently over the northeast. And what that makes for this kind of rapid fire propagation of disturbances over us that has made it quite active in terms of showers and rain and just generally unsettled weather. And the fact that, the work weeks are five-day long periods, Monday through Friday. Of course, you're likely to line up a nice day or two out of the five. And so then your brain connects that, oh, well, it was so beautiful on Wednesday, and now Saturday rolls around and it's raining. And it's a pattern that I guess we just were unlucky this spring that the nice days did not align with the weekends. Reflecting back to a year ago spring, though, I think last year was the other way around. I kind of recall that the weekends were frequently beautiful. And that's kind of the bottom line to our region. I often tell people that, you know, what Mother Nature gifts you one year or one season, you know, she'll make up for the other way the next year. Snow lovers, you know, it's classic. You know, you get a snowy winter and then, you know, you get a dud, and it all tends to even out in the long run.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We're talking weather today. Weather 101 with Eric Hurst, director of the Weather Information Center at Millersville University. Your opportunity to ask questions about the weather, 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. You can send an email to us at smarttalk@witf.org. Leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Eric, you said that right now we're in a pattern where the jet stream is over the north, and that's what's contributing to our off and on wet weather, cool weather, that kind of thing. Typically, or maybe typically is not a good word, maybe I should ask if it's typical, how long do weather patterns last over an area, or does it depend?
Well, it does depend, but often a weather pattern can click in for several weeks to a couple of months. And the key thing that we look at is, and I mentioned this a moment ago, is blocking patterns. We're looking at the upper levels, kind of that jet stream level, 20 to 30,000 feet above the ground. It's at that level where the flow of air and movement of storms on a hemispheric, on a global scale, is most easily tracked, and patterns are distinguished, recognized. And for us here in the northeastern U.S., one of the key features we look for, believe it or not, is high pressure that forms over Greenland. Now, why Greenland? Well, in the North Atlantic Ocean, in the vicinity of Greenland and Iceland, there's a tendency for the weather to be one extreme or the other. Either a big high pressure can set up for weeks, sometimes months, or vice versa, they can get a very stormy pattern. And whatever's happening up there, we tend to have the opposite. It's what we call a teleconnection. And it's a very interesting thing that you can look at one part of the world, Greenland, and actually conclude something about another part of the world here in the northeastern U.S. And so when there's a big, stable, high pressure over Greenland, the effect of that is, on a large scale, on a hemispheric scale, is to drive or push the jet stream to the south and west of Greenland, essentially down over New England, over the northeastern U.S. And that has been the case since March, and is still somewhat to the case. The pattern is kind of about run its course. We're on the last legs of it, you might say, but even, you know, into early next week, there's a little bit of a high-pressure ridge over Greenland that's going to keep that jet stream displaced down over New England, and as long as it's zipping by across New York and New England and across northern Pennsylvania, we're going to have these cold fronts come through. We're going to have these opportunities for passing showers. There could be an isolated thunderstorm this afternoon. And I guess my expectation is, Scott, by mid-June, this may have all played out. And so as we get into the second half of June, we may get into a more stable pattern where kind of the warm, sunny, 80-degree days will be more common.
So if
go ahead.
What I was going to say is, so if I looked at the radar over Greenland, obviously that just looking at the radar doesn't tell me whether it's a high pressure system, low pressure system, or anything like that, but just tells me whether it's precipitation or clear weather. If I looked at the radar over Greenland, me as a layperson, would I be able to tell that what could be happening in the near future over the United States?
The radar wouldn't really be the tool to track that. You know, Greenland's a big country, so first of all, where would you look? It's largely an unpopulated area, too. There's a few cities here and there along the coast, but otherwise just a lot of ice and wet tundra. The tool to really view this phenomena, this blocking pattern, is a weather chart, a jet stream chart, a chart that shows how the winds are blowing around the Earth. It's the type of chart that really only a meteorologist or a pilot, like if you're an international pilot, you need to know that information as well, where the jet stream winds are blowing. And so it is a little bit more of a esoteric chart. It's not something that a layperson could so much look at and without at least a little bit of understanding of meteorology, it would be a tough thing to kind of sort out. Mm. But it is a definitive connection. It's something that we've recognized, meteorologists long before me recognized, probably going back to the 40s or 50s, 50 years ago, that there's this connection between patterns over the North Atlantic and over the eastern United States. And by the way, there's a similar connection to the North Atlantic and what's occurring over, say, Great Britain. So forecasters over in the UK are pretty savvy in recognizing kind of those causal connections as well and using it as a tool, not so much to make daily forecasts, but just to get a sense of the overall pattern. Because even within an unstable pattern, you can get a nice day now and then. So it's not a connection that makes the daily forecast for us, but it's looking at that Greenland teleconnection is something that gives us a sense of the larger trend. And that larger trend in recent weeks has been unsettled with roller coaster temperatures and more than our share of precipitation.
Donna emails us asking, are atmospheric troughs becoming more prevalent and problematic in central PA weather?
Yeah, well, a trough is, again, that's kind of a technical term, and a trough is similar to a low-pressure center, and I guess the short answer is no. There's no difference in, if you look at the last 50 years, there's not a higher frequency of low pressure or of a trough over Pennsylvania. One thing I'm seeing, Scott, is there's terminology that is being introduced to the public in recent years. It probably has to do with social media to some degree, but also that weather's just a hot topic to talk about. These introduction of terms to the layperson, like a trough, or a big one a few winters ago was polar vortex.
Yeah.
And bomb cyclone, and so these terms get put out to the public. And the public's like, what is a bomb cyclone? I've never heard of that term before. Like, it's a new phenomena that hasn't occurred before. And in reality, the term bomb cyclone's been around for more than 50 years. It's just a nickname for a low pressure that forms very, very quickly and strengthens at a high rate. In the old days, it was just a term among meteorologists and our textbooks. But all of a sudden, it's got put out to the public, and the public's like, oh, my gosh. There's this new bomb cyclone I have to worry about every day.
polar vortex definitely was that. That was a catchphrase you heard a lot of people talking about.
That's right. And a polar vortex is just a large pocket of cold air in the upper levels, kind of jet stream and above, that resides over the North Pole but gets displaced away from the North Pole during the winter season, and it can be displaced towards the Siberian side of the pole, or it can get displaced towards our side of the pole, down across Canada and towards the border of the United States. So that's a kind of a sloshing of Arctic air across the pole back and forth, which is a natural movement. And some winters we see the sloshes coming more this way, the polar vortex coming in our direction, and other winters it goes the other direction. And so again, it's a natural movement. It's nothing unusual. What's unusual is that the term polar vortex was put out to the public I guess maybe frighten some people thinking, oh my gosh, there's this new polar vortex I need to worry about. Add it to the list.
Well, vortex sounds like something that came out of Star Trek. Let's take a call from Michael in Lititz. Michael, you're on the air.
Well, hello, gentlemen. How are you?
We're doing well.
Good.
Hey, I was just, you bursted my thunder, Eric. I was going to say bombogenesis. but you took it away from me.
Yeah, it's a great term. It sounds exciting, but it's nothing new.
No, I figured I wanted to tell you first that I'm a proud alumni of the State University of New York College at Oneonta. It was well known for its meteorology school.
You bet, for sure.
Yeah, and I just put.
Michael, you there? I think, I don't know why we lost Michael, but wanted to find out, his question was, he wanted to know if we are ahead of our yearly precipitation totals, what will it look like for the balance of the year?
Right. Well, yes, we are tracking ahead by about, let me just take a look at our Millersville numbers here, because that's the easiest way for, easiest thing for me to reference. And here, specifically at the Millersville Weather Center, we're tracking 6.5 inches above average, and that's substantial. You know, we've had about 23 inches of rain through just the first 5 months of the year, and so we're well ahead of things. Like I said, there's no drought imminent this summer, thank goodness. Will that trend continue? Well, I'm not so sure. Like I mentioned, the pattern is showing signs of change. As we get into late June and into midsummer, I think we're going to settle into kind of a run-of-the-mill summer pattern here. I don't see it being an extreme summer either way. We'll probably get our share of 90-degree days and our share of afternoon thunderstorms. But things may become a little more average, if you will. As we get into fall and winter, well, that's pretty far down the road. I can allude to that if you like, but I don't have any strong signals to lean on. So
no, we'll talk about that.
Yeah. Okay.
I think Mike, are you back on the line?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I apologize for that. Joe Cantore took my phone and disconnected it. That was a joke. That was a joke. The second part of my question, Eric, was, and you were talking about the, you know, the terms that are being, you know, provided to this public relative to, you know, what you've known for many years. Can you explain to me what it means by heating degree days and cooling degree days or something? I hear that on AccuWeather all the time, and I have no clue what that means.
All right. Michael, thank you very much for your call. That is a good question, and we do hear that all the time, too.
You bet. That is a calculation that's done based on average that is most commonly used by people in the energy profession, the energy sector, involved in heating and cooling, in terms of how hard your heater has to work during the winter and how frequently and how extensively your air conditioner has to work during the summer. And so there's a base value. It may vary by region. I'm not an expert on other regions, but let's say here in Lancaster, the base value of 65, well, for every degree you're above that, it's assumed you have to turn on your air conditioner. So it's a number that at the end of a month, you can do a calculation on heating degree days and cooling degree days. For example, if I look back to the month of April here at Millersville, we had, and using 65 as the base, we had a heating degree day value of 564. Now, that's a pretty esoteric number. What does 564 mean? But it has to do with our average temperature from the day, how far it departs from 65, and then that value gives you a sense of how cold or warm a month was. And so if a month has a higher heating degree day value, it's assumed you had to run your heater harder. You know, you had to heat your house, spend more money, or consume more energy to warm your house. Or in the summer, a cooling degree day is how much energy you need to use to cool given the climate of that month. And so it's a way to kind of compare months. That's the bottom line. If you look at some heating bills, will include a heating or cooling degree day value, and then it will say this is what it was last year, and you can make some kind of a comparison. So it's a bit confusing and a bit esoteric, but for people in that energy sector, it's a meaningful number.
Daphne is in Camp Hill. Daphne, you're on the air. Hello, Daphne? All right, let me try this. Whoops, we lost Daphne. Hello, is this Daphne?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay, I have been complaining about the level of rain of the past 5 days, and I call it the monsoon season because I'm the gardener. I'm a gardener, and I need to work in my garden after the spring bulbs are all done and then prepare the summer garden. And when it rains that much as it has the past 5 years in May and also in June, you just can't do it, you know. And then July, you become so hot and humid, you can't do anything then. So this year, I wasn't here for the rainy May because I was stuck in the airplane in the Washington Baltimore Airport for 4 hours on the 15th or so of May, because all the thunderstorms were coming from the west, and we were stuck in there like a Noah's Ark with all the rain on the outside. And I was in another, in the northwest, so I saw the rain here on the television, but...
Yep. Oh, I know.
The past 4 years, I was really exasperated that I couldn't do my work in the garden.
Daphne, thank you very much for your call. I mean, what Daphne points out, Eric, is that there are practical results from wet weather like we've had. Now, she was talking about gardens, and that's one thing. But people whose livings depend on it, like farmers, that when it's too wet, obviously they like rain for their crops, but when it's too wet, they can't get out in the field. There are some practical results from this weather.
Yeah, huge. Construction industry is a big one. You know, if they're replacing a roof on a house, or if they have a concrete pour, or, you know, road crews, PennDOT. I mean, there's many industries. And that's actually, something that in, I guess, the last 10 or 20 years, industry has really become more savvy on how to use weather data. The farmers have always been smart because they live out in the weather and can look at the sky, and they're almost excellent amateur forecasters, by just looking at the sky. But wide range of industries are now learning how to leverage weather data, and it's actually something we spend a lot of time working with our students on here and training them on, is how weather information can be used by a variety of businesses. Wall Street is a big time user of weather data because of how everything from if there's a freeze in the orange groves of Florida, it's going to affect the price of orange futures. If there's a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico, it's going to affect the price of oil and gas. Weather, it's hard to name a profession that weather doesn't affect, it seems.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Eric Hurst, director of the Weather Information Center at Millersville University. We're talking about the weather, answering your weather questions. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Eric, I have several emails I want to get to. Steve says, weather is really a three-dimensional creature. Weather maps just show the two-dimensional aspect of the weather. But when a high pressure enters the area with a clockwise rotation, does this really mean that the air is falling from upper atmosphere, bringing along the clockwise rotation? And conversely, with a low pressure counterclockwise rotation, does this really signify the removal of air from lower altitudes into higher altitudes, creating the counterclockwise rotation of the air? Thus, weather is a three-dimensional creature that the weather maps never signify. Just like water leaving a sink drain, the rotation is not a two-dimensional phenomena, but a three-dimensional model. What about that, Eric?
You bet. I mean, that's the first challenge, I guess, for a young meteorology student is, when you view weather on television or in the newspaper or in a book, it's two-dimensional. You're looking at, weather maps on a page, and you arrive in the weather center and you realize you have to be able to visualize and understand the atmosphere in three dimensions, and actually time as a fourth dimension, because things are moving and changing and evolving over time. And so that's one of the challenges of a meteorologist, is being able to visualize these things. And luckily we have computers and modeling and various tools that help us today visualize that third dimension and kind of get inside of a storm and get, you know, with, say, Doppler radar, get inside of a rotating thunderstorm and understand the mechanics of it. And if you can observe more accurately and understand, you know, what's going on dynamically within a storm, hopefully that makes you a better forecaster as well. And so getting back to his basic question is, yeah, high pressure on the large scale, air is subsiding, and sinking air dries out, and clouds dissipate when air is subsiding over top of you. With low pressure on a large scale, air is going upward. If you have a thunderstorm, the air is moving very quickly upward. If you have a hurricane, air is moving massively upward over a large scale. But still, within that larger storm environment, there can be pockets where air is sinking. Like if you look at a hurricane on a satellite picture, you see spiral bands of clouds. And those spiral bands are comprised of thunderstorms where there's massive upward motion, rising air, condensing and forming clouds and heavy precipitation. But between those spiral bands, there's breaks in the clouds. The air is actually sinking within the domain of a hurricane in certain spots. The eye of a hurricane, the air is sinking. That's why the sky's clear for a brief time if you're in the eye of a hurricane. And so those are the complexities of the atmosphere. If you come to Millersville, you can study for 4 years to come to grasp those complexities.
Quick question. I told you I would ask some basic questions out there that maybe a lot of people have. Why do hurricanes move west to east? Or excuse me, east to west. I'm sorry.
Right. Well, that is the prevailing direction of tropical cyclones that form in the Atlantic Ocean. They form down in the low latitudes between, say, 5 degrees north and 20 degrees north latitude. That's kind of that zone, the intertropical convergent zone. And the prevailing wind direction is from the east, are the easterlies in that kind of belt, that zone of latitude. The prevailing wind directions are from the east. And so when a system forms out in the middle of the Atlantic in that latitude zone, it will tend to be tracking from east to west. Now, as it recurves, as it moves up, like oftentimes towards the Gulf Coast or up along the east coast, as it moves into what we call the mid-latitudes, it begins to encounter the westerlies. The winds across the United States generally blow west to east, and hence the hurricanes, as they turn northward, eventually recurve and move the other direction as they're kind of exiting the United States or exiting North America. And so it's a function of the general wind direction on where a storm is at in its life cycle. And since they tend to originate in the lower latitudes, where the winds are blowing from east to west, that's what the movement usually is when they first form. But as they evolve and move away from where they were born, they get affected by other wind currents and, of course, can turn north or even eventually they turn back, moving west to east. So.
Jason from Lancaster asks, are there any studies that quantify the accuracy of weather forecasts? Specifically, it seems like there should be a correlation between accuracy and how far ahead in time the forecast is.
Yeah, I'll tell you, that's a tough one. And there are studies, and there are some studies done just very simply comparing different forecasting agencies on how much snow they forecasted or on temperatures. And, you know, those types of studies have a little bit of value. You might be able to figure out locally, is one meteorologist better than another or one source of weather information better than another. But there's also some subjectivity to those analyses. In terms of what professional meteorologists spend more time comparing is actually the skill of the computer models. These are the numerical simulations of the atmosphere that help us make weather forecasts. And there's a variety of computer models, some generated here in the United States and some in other countries, other agencies. And when we're comparing those models, we tend to look at the jet stream level because that is kind of where it all begins for us as meteorologists, is where are the wind currents, where is the energy, where is the rotation. And if you can identify that accurately in the mid-levels of the atmosphere at that jet stream level, you can then make a good accurate forecast for the surface of the Earth where we live. And so we do compare computer models and their skill as well.
Let's take a phone call from Nancy in Greencastle. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
I noticed years ago that there seemed to be a lot of discussion about climate change and so forth, and really on the Weather Channel is where I first noticed it, and it was like, wow, this is good, you know, that they are actually, you know, putting science and so forth out. And I've noticed that it just disappeared, and I was wondering if you had any understanding or insight. Was that driven by politics, or did they just decide that people weren't interested in it, or what happened to it?
All right, thank you very much for your call. Eric?
Well, when it comes to television, I'm not sure. I'm not in that industry, but I do know that when it comes to programming, even on whether it's a sports channel or a weather channel, they do surveys with their viewers and find out what attracts them. And the things that get them to stay tuned in, they'll talk more about. And the things that people aren't interested in, they do less of. So I don't know if they've studied that. I know most TV stations know that snow equals ratings, so they love to talk about snow.
Yeah.
and monger snowstorms during the winter. I can't get inside the mind of the Weather Channel. I can only imagine that they, as businessmen, are going to talk about what gets them viewers. So,
well, we have several climate change questions. Tyler is in Waynesboro. Tyler, you're on the air.
Hi, Eric. I know you're a climber, and I've read a couple of your books. And my question is, how has climate change affected the sport of rock climbing and alpine climbing?
That's a very interesting question. I am a rock climber. I've been into rock climbing as long as I've been into meteorology, which is many decades, and I've climbed around the world. And, I'm not an alpinist, so I don't climb high-altitude mountains like in Nepal, let's say. So in my specialty of rock climbing, I don't really think there's been an impact of climate change on rock climbing that I do, say, in a place like Yosemite or in the Schwanggunks of New York or in the south of France. But certainly as you get into alpine climbing and mountaineering, there's been observations of, the glaciers have withdrawn and are less expansive, exposing more ground that wasn't exposed to climbers, say, 30 years ago. I guess on some of the bigger mountains, if there's a longer melt season, that makes rockfall a greater concern, because when mountains are melting, there's more rock released. Again, I'm thinking Himalayan-type mountain climbing. But there's also a few spots in the world where the glaciers have actually expanded and gotten longer. I think that's the exception, not the rule. But it's a complex picture, and it varies somewhat from region to region. And it's probably most noticeable as you get into the higher latitudes, because that's really where most of the climate change has been observed, at least in terms of temperature change, is at the higher latitudes.
David asked a question about climate change. He says, I understand that there is more moisture in the atmosphere due to global warming. Could this be the cause of the above average precipitation we've been experiencing?
That's a great question, and there is some data to suggest that could be the case. I need to preface this, first of all, that climate change, climate science is not my area of expertise.
I think it's a good thing to do.
I'm pretty much on top of this stuff, but there's other people that are more credentialed than I am to speak on this subject. But yes, a warmer Earth atmosphere system will naturally have more evaporation from the ocean. So the Earth has warmed a little over a degree Celsius over the last 100 years. Doesn't sound like a big number, but over a large scale, it is significant. And so a slightly warmer atmosphere has more water vapor in it. and more water vapor obviously would tend to lead you down the path of thinking, hey, there could be more precipitation, more rains. Now, in some parts of the world, it's actually been drier, but there's some areas, one of which is the northeastern U.S., where there's some data to suggest that heavy rainfall events and perhaps heavy snowfall events are a bit more common now than they were, say, 50 or 100 years ago. I'm thinking like kind of that megalopolis of the northeastern U.S. There's some data to support that heavy downpours and heavy snowstorms are a bit more likely now than they were, say, 50 or 100 years ago. And there's some belief that that could be connected to more water vapor in the atmosphere. Though, again, we're splitting hairs. I don't think, like, any of these conclusions are set in stone. There are other things that affect our climate on a regional or even a continental basis, you know, blocking patterns and even the oceans. There's these multi-decadal variations in both the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean, movements of water, warm and cold water, that are natural cycles that can have impact on trends over the course of decades. And so to unwind all that is a very complex subject, and I tend to leave it to the people that are smarter than me. So
let's take a call from Susan in Lancaster. Susan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I love this show because I could watch the Weather Channel for hours on end. I've always wondered about something. When you're showing a weather map on TV and you're talking about troughs and ridges, okay? And you mentioned before about like weather being three-dimensional, obviously. But when you show that a trough and a ridge, is that oriented in two dimensions, like down to the south and up to the north, or is it three-dimensional up into the atmosphere and down to the ground? Do you know what I mean?
Yes. And the answer is yes to both of those questions. So let me take a shot at this here. When we're looking at a weather map, whether it's a surface weather map showing where the fronts are at, or whether it's a jet stream map, say at 500 millibars, which is approximately 20,000 feet above the ground, we can look at those maps and see the reflection or we can see indication of a trough axis or a ridge axis at different levels of the atmosphere. We can see it at the surface. We can see it if we look at a chart for higher up in the atmosphere. And so there is a connection three-dimensionally. If there's a trough at the surface, as you go up through the atmosphere, you're going to find a trough above it. Now, they're not always perfectly aligned. So when you're looking at things in the third dimension, the troughs can lag. The kind of the trough at 500 millibars up at jet stream level does not align perfectly with at the surface. And so that's one of the very difficult things for meteorologists, is both that surface trough and that upper level trough have ways of triggering showers and lines of storms to develop. And with one situation, showers and thunderstorms might form with the surface trough, and in another situation, they might be triggered by the upper-level trough. And I know we're getting kind of into 200-level meteorology here, but I guess I'm trying to explain that what you're describing is accurate and correct, but it's a little difficult to explain on a layperson level, because it does start to get into the weeds of meteorology.
Eric, we only have a minute left, and there's so many other questions. Want to thank you very much for being with us today. I had a quick one, though. 70% chance of rain. Does it mean 7 chances out of 10 that it will rain, or 70% of the area receives rain in about 30 seconds or less?
Yeah, the former. You know, when we look at a weather situation like today, for example, we kind of think in our head, and our computer models statistically, we'll look at past similar situations. And so given today's situation, if it's a 30% forecast, that means in past similar situations, 30% of the time it showered and 70% it didn't. So it's a probabilistic forecast. It's not based on coverage at all. That would be a misunderstanding of that forecast.
All right. I lied. 5 seconds or less here. Wind northwest, 10 to 15 miles per hour. Out of the northwest or blowing toward the northwest?
Yeah, that's commonly confused. It's from the northwest. We name winds by where they come from. So an easterly wind comes from the east.
Eric Hurst is the director of the Weather Information Center at Millersville University. Eric, lots of fun today. Thanks a lot.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And I want to thank Eric Hurst. I know you have a lot of other questions. Hey, next Smart Talk Road Trip, we celebrate Made in America Tour Week at the home of an American icon. Join us next Wednesday, June 13th at Harley-Davidson Vehicle Operations in York. We'll discuss the role of manufacturing in Pennsylvania's economy. Plus, stick around after the show for a tour of the plant. RSVP today at WITF.org/events. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to talk about early childhood education and its importance. That's coming up on tomorrow's program.